Hello, it's Friday the 7th of May. I'm Andrew Pearce and this is The Andrew Pearce Show. And as ever, it's coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up from May the 17th, we can have people to stay or we can stay at people's homes. But I'm talking to a writer who says, no way does she want anybody staying at her house, and she's not staying at theirs. She doesn't like their rough towels. Also, gambling. New figures showing even more of us have been sucked into online gambling during the pandemic. We're talking, of course, on a mega day in politics, the biggest electoral test outside of a general election. The Tories have made gains in all sorts of places they're not supposed to, but most of all, they've won the Hartlepool by-election with the biggest swing from an opposition party since the Second World War. So the Conservative Party has made the first gains as Council England begin to declare results. And of course, there is the landslide victory in Hartlepool, in the Hartlepool by-election. The Prime Minister has described the results as encouraging, understatement of the year in my view, adding this is because the government has been focusing on our priorities, the people's priorities, and bouncing back from the pandemic as much as we can. I'm joined now by Jo Twyman, who's co-founder and director of Delta Poll. Jo, we've talked a lot about this. The Boris bounce is huge. And who would have thought we'd have seen an inflatable dummy of Boris put up outside the count by the Tories?
Yes, it's certainly a good result for the Conservatives, and really a reflection of the kind of patterns that we've been seeing in the polling over the last few months. We've seen, for instance, that Conservative support correlates very closely with people's perceptions of how well the government is dealing with the pandemic. We've seen that the Conservatives are pretty much mopping up all of the support among Leave voters. And we've seen that increasingly the Conservatives are doing well among working class voters. Now, you combine all of those things and you get what is essentially a good time and a good place for a by-election to take place from the Conservatives' point of view in Hartlepool, given the situation with the previous Brexit Party support no longer being able to vote for that party and so being able to go elsewhere, and also demographics favouring the Conservatives on top of COVID casting a shadow over everything. And so right time, right place, and the Conservatives were able to deliver.
Are we witnessing something else here, Joe? Are we now really seeing a fundamental realignment of British politics? Because the Tories have won Harlow. Now, they've got a very popular Tory MP in Harlow, but they've won the council there. They've won Dudley, which I started thinking about my history as the cradle of the Industrial Revolution. These are councils which you wouldn't necessarily expect them to win, but they are forging ahead from the gains they made in December 2019 in the general election, which in itself was their best result for 1987. Is it fundamentally realigned? And if that is the case, what do Labour do?
Well, it certainly could be the case, but really the unusual situation we still find ourselves in means it's impossible to tell for sure, or to the degree to which it is the case. If you go back to October, for instance, when the government was doing much worse when it came to dealing with the pandemic and Labour were ahead in a number of the polls, if the elections had taken place then, the situation could have, I imagine, have been very different. I don't think we'll know exactly how long-lasting this search for the Conservatives is until we move out of the era of COVID fears around short-term health concerns and move on to COVID fears about economic recovery and bouncing back and all that sort of thing. And I think that's where Labour really can start to make inroads potentially, because it strikes me that at the moment setting the groundwork for that, thinking long term and starting to attempt to place doubts in the minds of the electorate, and then further down the line we'll attempt, in presumably in light of the inevitable public inquiries, they'll attempt to paint the Conservatives in a particular light. They'll talk about fairness, they'll talk about equality, and whether everyone is truly benefiting from the economic growth that we expect and the kind of stimulus that will bring. And then if in turn the government's own competence is brought into question in the aftermath and the post-mortem of the pandemic, then that may benefit Labour. But there's no doubt that at the moment Labour are really confined to, well, essentially Wales, London, and then university metropolitan towns and cities. And the Conservatives are doing a very good job of mopping up everywhere else.
Firstly, just finally, Joe, is there a problem for Labour with their leader? Because you can talk to any Labour MP you like and they'll say, oh, well, poor Keir Starmer, he's still dealing with the legacy of Jeremy Corbyn. But this is a very, very bad result for Labour. The third Labour leader in succession, who's come from a particular part of North London, which someone like me would describe as very metropolitan, and they're doing very badly in non-metropolitan areas. If there is a problem with a Labour leader, where do they go next? Because they went hard left with Corbyn and it didn't work. They've gone centrist with Starmer and it's not working.
That is, in a sense, the problem that they have. If they don't go for Starmer, who else is the replacement? There really is no obvious person who can point to and say that person would have done better. And of course, some people say, oh, well, Jeremy Corbyn won in Hartlepool. Jeremy Corbyn did not win in Hartlepool with the Brexit Party not running during a pandemic. So the comparisons for that are not valid. And so Labour definitely is in need of new thinking at the moment. But at the same time, it may prove to be the case that that Keir Starmer is the best that they can go for and best that they can hope for longer term. His own personal ratings remain actually relatively quite good. It's just that Boris Johnson's are better. But his are certainly significantly better than Jeremy Corbyn's were at any stage. And so I would say it's cause concern for the Labour Party and something to keep an eye on, but not necessarily a need for wholesale change. The last thing they want to do is throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Very interesting. That's Joe Twyman, who's co-founder and director of Delta Poll. So if you enjoy The Andrew Pearce Show, why don't you subscribe to us? Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Google or Spotify. And if you want to get in touch, tweet us at Mel Plus or me at Tory Boy Pearce. So the Hartlepool result, historic, extraordinary and all those words that have been used to describe it, boosts the Prime Minister's majority in the House of Commons and also hands him another brick in Labour's so-called Red War. The huge swing to the Tories, the biggest to a governing party in a by-election since the Second World War, confirms the scale of the political earthquake that's been happening in the North East. I'm joined now by Jake Berry, who is chairman of the Northern Research Group, and he is the Conservative MP for Rossendale and Darwin. Well, Mr. Berry, you must be feeling a bit more relaxed about your majority after that earthquake in Hartlepool.
Yeah, it's a fantastic result for a governing party. I mean, let's not forget, 11 years and four elections into a Conservative government to be snatching what were absolutely regarded for a generation as safe Labour seats from Keir Starmer. I mean, great for us, a complete catastrophe, I think, for his leadership in the Labour Party.
Do you put it down to, is it the Boris bounce, the Boris effect? Because I don't think Theresa May would have enjoyed that sort of support in a constituency like Hartlepool. Is it still linked also, Mr. Berry, to Brexit and the fact the Labour candidate was not just an arch Remainer, he was almost fanatical about getting Britain back in the EU?
Well, I mean, I think people do see and understand that that Boris Johnson is a Prime Minister who has delivered on his promise for Brexit. But, you know, having been to Hartlepool myself and worked with colleagues up there in this campaign, I think it's more fundamental than that. People were impatient for change. They've had decades of Labour control with very few or noticeable improvements in the place they live in, and they want things to get better. I think they voted for change, and I know Boris Johnson and our government, with its levelling up agenda, will deliver that change for them.
I was talking to a trade union figure the other day. I'm writing about this in the Mail, in the paper tomorrow. He says he can't believe that a Labour Party has allowed a Tory government led by an old Etonian like Boris Johnson to be leading the way in levelling up. And you've just got to think, who would have thought a Tory mayor would nationalise an airport, which is what happened with Teesside International Airport?
Yeah, I mean, Ben Houchen is an extraordinary mayor. I think quite a lot of this victory can be laid at his door. I think when you look at his record, voting Conservative just looks like the smart thing to do. I mean, we all have very similar ambitions for our family, better hospitals, children to get on in education, better jobs, higher wages. And Ben's really demonstrated that he's the person who's getting on and delivering it. And I think people have backed his vision and backed the Prime Minister's vision more widely for the nation.
Politicians always have to be wary of hubris, Mr. Berry. Is there a downside here? Is there a danger that the Prime Minister may take his eye off the ball and think, oh, well, we've got an economic recovery coming next year and become a bit complacent?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, what people have shown in recent elections in Hartlepool and in other areas is their sort of that they are politically mobile. And I don't think any Conservative MP, including me in my marginal seat of Rossendale and Darwin, will be taking the electorate or the promises we have made to them for granted. And I think also a big challenge is not just for us, but going around Hartlepool, asking people, what does Keir Starmer stand for? I don't think anyone really knows. I don't think anyone knows what the Labour Party stands for. In fact, he's sort of unclear Starmer, isn't he, rather than Keir Starmer. But I think the greater challenge isn't just for the Conservatives, but I think the Labour Party is at a defining moment. And what it really needs to do is show the electorate, you know, what they can do.
Very interesting. That's Jake Berry, who is the chairman of the Northern Research Group of Conservative MPs and the MP for Rossendale and Darwin. And I'm going to pinch that line, if you don't mind, Mr. Berry.
I
like that. That's going to be in the Daily Mail tomorrow. Keir Starmer, unclear Starmer. Sorry, like that very much. If you want to get in touch, you can tweet us at Mail Plus or me at Tory Boy Pierce. The Conservatives have scored what can only be described as an historic win in Hartlepool, a constituency which has been held by Labour since its inception in the 1970s, but even in its previous form, the Tories only held it once since the Second World War. Labour leader Sir Keir Starmer is facing calls to change direction from Labour's left wing, and I suspect from some on the right of the party, after he became the first leader to see the party lose Hartlepool since all those years ago. I'm joined now by Lord Adonis. He was the head of Tony Blair's policy unit and was Transport Secretary under Gordon Brown. This is all your fault, Lord Adonis, because Labour got rid of that very nice Jeremy Corbyn, who led them to their worst defeat since 1935, but at least he held on to Hartlepool. And you've got Keir Starmer in there, who's a man carved in your own image, centrist, Blairite, moderniser, and he's lost Hartlepool, worst Labour by-election result ever.
But the lesson of Hartlepool is that you can't half reform a party. Jeremy Corbyn obviously had to go. There's no way that the Labour Party was going to be able to win Middle England, whether, you know, in the Red Wall in the north or the counties in the south, if it had a Marxist far left leader, you know, with a manifesto at the last election, which on one assessment would have cost £1 trillion in nationalisation. And he wasn't even prepared to condemn President Putin and Russia after the Salisbury poisoning. So the Corbyn leadership was totally unviable, and it's amazing that the Labour Party managed to recover from it at all after 2019. But Keir, who's a very decent man and a very nice man, actually, the big challenge for him has been to do a Blair-like revolution inside the party, and that hasn't happened. And the verdict of the voters yesterday is that it simply isn't working, and people have to draw the conclusions from that.
He's only had a year, and he's also had to do this in a pandemic when it's very difficult for a leader of the opposition to get noticed, to be able to get into the political narrative.
Well, it's certainly true. It's been 14 months, and it's certainly true we're in a pandemic. But there are other countries that have been in pandemics in that time, and they've had dramatic political changes. Remember Donald Trump? He lost an election to Joe Biden. That was in the middle of the pandemic. The same has just been happening in India. President Macron is under huge pressure because he's not seen to be handling the pandemic well in France. So the truth of the matter is that two things are happening at the moment. Boris Johnson has had a good few months, his equivalent to the Falklands with the vaccination campaign. That's certainly true. But that makes it all the more important that you have a Labour leader who can articulate a strong, compelling, dynamic and modern vision for the future, particularly on jobs and the economy, which means people being prepared to trust their taxes with the Labour Party. And that's always been the Achilles heel of Labour in the past, is on the one hand, they want better public services, they want more opportunity in society, they want more aspiration, they like education, 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 which was Tony Blair's great mantra, but they want a Labour leader they can trust, who they believe is patriotic and in the centre ground. And the truth of the matter is that Labour still isn't even in that ballpark at the moment. And that's why we had this drubbing in Hartlepool. And I have a terrible feeling things could get worse. There's no ordained, you know, there's no divine right of parties to exist. They can and do vanish. So we've got to be very careful in this crisis.
I mean, if there is a fundamental realignment going on here, Lord Adonis, are we looking now potentially at the demise of the Labour Party? I mean, the Liberal Democrats have virtually sank without trace. I think they came 19th or something in Hartlepool. But is there a potential now? Are you seriously saying Labour could end up out of business?
I am. I think it could be curtains for the Labour Party. We need to contemplate that possibility. If you look at France is quite interesting because its politics and its economy and all that aren't a million miles apart from us. President Macron in France, the big challenge to him is not coming from Social Democrats and the centre. It's not even coming from the conventional centre-right, you know, people like our Conservative Party. It's coming from the National Front and the populist right. And we know that populism is virulent because we've seen so much of it, including, let's be frank, Nigel Farage and the Brexit Party here over the last 10 years. The reason it's virulent is because our economies have been doing very badly and people aren't well off and many of them haven't got jobs. In Hartlepool, where this by-election was yesterday, real living standards in Hartlepool have fallen over the last decade. Why is it that they're voting Tory? Because they believe that, Johnson is the only person who appears to offer any future. But if he fails or doesn't have a sufficiently compelling story, which I think is distinctly possible because we all know Boris and his problems with delivery, and we have a very weak Labour Party, I wouldn't be at all surprised if we don't see a new populist right-wing movement coming up. And that's all the more reason why my friends in the Labour Party have really got to get a grip on this situation.
Why wait for a populist party on the right to come forward? Why can't you, Lord Adonis? You're a clever man. You ran Tony Blair's policy unit. You know how it works. Why don't you set up a new party? Tony Blair, Peter Mandelson, they're clearly deeply disillusioned with what's going on. They've still got political clout, haven't they?
Well, I'm a Social Democrat. What I want to see is a modern, dynamic, forward-looking Labour Party led by people like Tony Blair. You know, maybe we need more Tony Blair himself in the situation we're in at the moment. And I think that could be a way back for Labour. But the big lesson of yesterday is that the most effective leader wins in these elections. In modern television elections, you've got to be able to play well on the box and say in pretty pithy ways what is your vision for the country, and in particular how you're going to make your median voter, you know, your middle voter in Hartlepool, feel better off in a few years' time. And it's not exactly, as I say, as if they feel that everything is solved now. Even if they supported Brexit or admire Boris Johnson because of the vaccine, nonetheless, real wages have fallen in the last 10 years. Educational standards, and I'm passionate about education as a former education minister, they're still pitiful in Hartlepool. There is a real opening for a constructive and really engaged and forward-looking centrist Social Democratic Party at the moment, and Labour needs to be that, but it needs a really good leader if it's going to do it.
So let me ask you, he's not up to it, he can't do it, he's a nice guy, you say, damned with faint praise, if you don't mind me saying that, Lord Adonis. Has he got to resign, Sir Keir Starmer? If you need a new leader, he's got to go, hasn't he?
Well, Keir needs to make these decisions for himself. What I've said today is that it's very clear, you just need to look at the results of these elections, that Keir is a transitional figure. He was a necessary figure because somebody had to take over this shipwreck from Jeremy Corbyn. And some of us hoped that he might have the political leadership skills and the vision to do the task I've just described of painting a vision of a really dynamic, forward-looking economy that could deliver the jobs, the prosperity and the aspiration in places like Hartlepool. But it's now clear he's a transitional figure. And the question is what he's transitioning to. And in my experience of politics, you don't want to be in a no man's land for too long.
Cassie, just finally, isn't the real problem with Labour leadership is this, Lord Adonis? The last three Labour leaders, as very bluntly pointed out to me by a trade unionist, could all get to each other's homes in 10 minutes on a bus. In other words, North London metropolitan elite. I'm thinking Miliband, Corbyn, Islington and Keir Starmer, all within a 10-minute bus ride of each other. Isn't it time Labour went out to its northern heartland? Isn't it time perhaps Labour even thought about getting somebody who was working class as party leader?
Well, I think you should go for the best leader. Remember, Boris Johnson lives around the corner from those three.
But don't you think, but hang on, let me just pin you down on that point. Isn't that a problem that the last three leaders have all come from the same North London patch?
No, I don't think that that's the issue. I think the issue is they haven't had the capacity to cut through with the public at large.
So you want another North London? You want another North London socialist to do it then, do you?
I think we want the best person, Andrew. We want the best leader. Remember, Tony Blair, who won three elections for Labour, he lived in Islington, but his constituency was in the North East. He really did understand, you know, Mondeo man, Worcester woman, we used to talk about. He understood it. Boris Johnson, he used to live literally round the corner. He lived by Angel Tube Station. I mean, right in the heart of Islington. This is the, you know, the citadel of North London, and he's now the darling of Hartlepool. So I don't think it's important not to try and segment the electorate in a kind of almost Marxist way and saying one group may support you, one group might not. England's a pretty unified country. Somebody who has a strong appeal, in the south coast is likely to have a strong appeal in Hartlepool. If you've got a weak appeal in Hartlepool, you're not going to appeal well in Bristol either. We need somebody who has real cut through, real vision, a capacity to speak to the whole country across classes and across regions. And that's the big, big challenge that Labour now has. And this is an absolutely mega wake-up call, what happened. You know, Labour's vote in Hartlepool yesterday fell by a quarter from Jeremy Corbyn's tally in 2019. And that was an electoral catastrophe. So parties have no divine right to exist. And unless we really get a grip on the situation, it may be that Labour gets replaced by something entirely different within a few years.
Just if you could indulge you finally, look, you've got very strong views on who shouldn't be Labour leader in form of Keir Starmer. Do you not have a view on who should be the next Labour leader? You know the people, you know them, you've met them, you've heard them speak. Who is it? And is it time they had a woman, by the way, Lord Adonis? More than half the electorate are women. Are they ever going to have a woman?
It would be great to have a really dynamic woman leader. It would be absolutely great. I think what we need to do now is have a wide field and a big assessment. I certainly don't think that the next leader should, in that search, we should limit the search to Parliament. We've got two very good mayors in Andy Burnham and Sadiq Khan. We've got my former boss, Tony Blair. I think we need all of these people engaged in what should be a big debate in the weeks ahead about the future of the Labour Party and then move on from there.
All right, that's Lord Adonis. He is the former head of policy for Tony Blair, a former transport secretary with a pretty pithy view. Keir has to go. So it's that time of the programme where we talk sport, and I was tempted to play the funeral march for the arrival of Matt Gatwood, the deputy sports editor of the Daily Mail, because he's an Arsenal fan, and even I know they're out. They got booted out of the... What cup was it, Matt?
The Europa League.
Right, against a team I've never heard of. Who did they lose to?
They lost to Villarreal.
Where are they from?
They're from Spain.
OK, what was the score?
0-0, which meant they lost 2-1 on aggregate.
OK, and how badly did they play?
Very badly.
Right.
It was appalling. A real limp performance. I mean, it was their season on the line. That was the only thing they've got left to play for. They're ninth in the Premier League, so there's no chance, you know, of qualifying for the Champions League through finishing in the top four. Mm. That's gone. So this was their lifeline. This was their chance. If they'd won this competition, they would have got back into the Champions League. And they went out with a whimper. I mean, they were appalling. They, you know, Villarreal must have thought, what's going on here? They never had
they
an
hit the
easy
post enough. Once.
Well, they hit the post twice, but okay. They, you know, they that was it. You know, that was it in the 90 minutes in a game where they needed to score. They had to score. Some of the selection was a bit baffling, and the performance was just really limp. Now, obviously, you know, suddenly Mikel Arteta, the manager, has become the favourite with the bookies to be the next coach to be sacked. But, you know, whoever comes in is going to have the similar group of players. And, you know, the problems don't just stop, I'm afraid, with the manager.
Is it just me or does he look 24?
Well, look, yeah, he's a young coach. It's his first job. But
right.
From what I hear, he is a brilliant coach on the actual training ground and he coaches these players brilliantly. He's obviously been very well schooled by Pep Guardiola. And Arsene Wenger when he was a player. And apparently he's a very good coach. You know, now I think he's got a little bit too clever maybe in some of the selection he's done of late. And he certainly has a couple of blind spots. But, I don't think the buck necessarily stops solely with Mikel Arteta.
Right. So you're a bit fed up?
I'm a little bit fed up, yeah, because that's the season gone, you know, and it's just like...
Well, if your team didn't get relegated to the lowest division like mine, Swindon Town, which I don't think the Daily Mail wrote much about.
That's very true. And look, as an Arsenal fan, we've not had a bad trot over the last 20 years. You know,
yeah.
Arsenal have won a lot of titles,
yeah.
And, you know, it could be worse. I could be a Swindon fan.
You
so
could.
That is always the saving grace.
Every cloud, Matt.
Exactly.
Every cloud.
Exactly.
Now, Lions rugby. I'm getting on quite well at this now. New squad announced for their tour of...
So they tour South Africa,
South Africa.
This
yeah.
summer. Yeah. So this was the tour that was meant to happen last year. Obviously
yeah.
was put back a year. And interesting selections made by Warren Gatland, the Lions coach yesterday. one of the biggest surprises was the fact that England favourite Kyle Sinclair missed out. He said he was gutted. A lot of people, in fact, everyone would have had him in their squads pretty much. So he's a surprise omission. And he won't be surprised to learn that the squad is packed full of big blokes, as they, you know, they're obviously taking on South Africa, who are a very big physical side. And he's packed the side full of big units. But a few surprises. Billy Vunipola, Saracens player, is not going. Elliot Daly is going, who might have thought himself a bit lucky because he, you know, barely has played pretty poorly all in all for the England team. And overall, you could say it's a bit of a two fingers up to Eddie Jones, the England coach, because the one inclusion, Sam Simmons, who's an Exeter player, can't get anywhere near the England team, yet has been chosen for the Lions team by Warren Gatland. So that is a bit of a two fingers to Eddie Jones and a sort of, why aren't you picking this bloke? If he's good enough for the Lions, he's good enough for England.
Yeah. And when does that start?
So that is in June, and they've picked a 37-man squad. So
that's a lot.
Three tests to look forward to.
Yeah.
So it will be great. You know, it will, whether there's fans in
COVID
there.
COVID permitting.
Yeah, COVID permitting, obviously. And, you know, the real shame is that there'll be no touring fans, because normally the British and Irish fans go out on these tours, and it's a brilliant festival of rugby and lots of tourists there mingling with the home fans, and it's a great atmosphere and a great thing to go on. And it's one of those holy grails for a sports fan to go on a Lions tour. So that's the sadness, that there'll be no fans there. But the rugby will be great, and it'll be good to watch.
That's Matt Gatland, who's switching to rugby because Arsenal keep letting him down.
Indeed.
Thanks for joining us. British gamblers lost £18 million a day in March, and that is being put down to the impact of the lockdown. This is according to a report by the Gambling Commission, which says £6 million of that money came from addictive online slot games. And the commission says Britain's placed 6.1 billion bets on slot games in March. That is an astonishing 2,400 every second. I'm joined now by Matt Gaskill. He's clinical lead for the Northern NHS Gambling Clinics. Mr. Gaskill, my eyes glaze over at the idea of 6.1 billion bets in March alone, 2,400 every second. Who are these people who are playing this? And are some of them probably very young?
Yes. So there's a real broad section of consumers who are using these online products. So, and yes, a lot of them are young people, and we're really concerned that so many young people are potentially getting hooked into online gambling. At that sort of more vulnerable age. I think the other thing as well is that it's the slot machines, which the headlines have particularly spoken of, and that's one of the most addictive gambling products in the world, packed full of psychological hooks and tricks to keep you gambling. So there's we're really alarmed by this data and what it means.
And it seems now that the fear among people about gambling, Mr. Gaskill, it's not anymore people standing in it or sitting in a bookmaker's for hours on end waiting for the next horse race to get underway. It is the online gambling, which is almost unseen. It could be somebody in their bedroom, in the office, doing it on their phone while they're walking to work even.
So what we're seeing is an epidemic of high-risk online gambling. As you say, usually there'd be some barriers in place. Not everybody wants to go into a bookmaker or into a casino. So much of this is hidden. People playing these rapid, continuous forms of gambling in solitude, and not knowing what the psychological state of the person is who might be engaging in these products, and not having anybody else around. The environment is particularly risky. The mode of delivery of these products is more high risk than you'd find elsewhere. The 2005 Gambling Act has just been a huge mistake. We know the government is reviewing the Gambling Act, but there's deep concern about, potentially how close the government are to the industry, or how much they're enjoying the fruits of the tax revenue, and not really paying the attention that's really needed to protect consumers from these high-risk products.
Remind listeners, if you would, Mr. Gaskill, what the 2005 Gambling Act did. Of course, it was brought in by Tony Blair's government.
That's right. It was, during the time of New Labour and the Labour Party opening up a bit more to big business and broadening, I suppose, the scope of their politics. But in doing so, it's unleashed what we see before our eyes today. You know, the gambling industry has grabbed hold of that opportunity and transformed gambling from what used to be behind frosted glass, really, if we look back, and no advertising. Now we've got advertising everywhere, rather aggressive marketing and advertising. £1.5 billion a year spent on advertising and marketing. The majority of that is online, again, so we see it on the TV, but most of it is online and targeted to people. And what they've done is they've pushed more and more people to the most addictive products. So rather than, you know, what used to be, you know, a future event, fairly low risk kind of gambling activities in the past, now we've got this push for continuous forms of gambling where you're in the action, you don't have the time to stop and reflect about what you're doing, and you're continually betting, and often some of the betting can get out of control quite easily with this casino gambling. And in-play football betting is another thing. You know, we've seen gambling being, you know, symptomatic with football and with sports. Yeah.
Yes, they encourage you to bet on who's going to score the next goal, what the score is going to be, and they're so sophisticated now, aren't they, Mr. Gaskill? These betting companies know if you're at the football match. I know that during lockdown that's not been so easy, and they bombard people while they're watching football matches with more inducements to gamble.
It's very, very carefully considered framing, you know, making the public see that gambling is something that's pretty harmless, a harmless leisure pursuit. But the reality is that, you know, that they're pushing people to the things that are going to produce the highest revenue. And that's what businesses do, of course. But in doing so, there's this rather irreconcilable problem that is in complete conflict with public health. And more people, more and more families, more and more communities are now seeing the consequences of gambling harm, and it can be so devastating to people. You know, we have suicide as well, and suicide risk as well. I mean, the problems that are behind what we see on the TV screens are absolutely devastating.
Can I ask you just finally, we know the government's been reviewing it. Government reviews take forever, don't they? Far too long. And as you say, some people are taking their own lives. And I think it's especially true of younger men who see their future blighted by the amount of debt they've got into. What do you want the government to do when the review is published? How can they prevent or at least discourage so many people from making these reckless wagers online?
It's difficult to know where to start because there's so many things that we'd like to see change. The first thing is to put public health first and put prevention first rather than these really obscene profits that we're seeing. Advertising, marketing, sponsorship, all of that needs to be addressed. Yes, gambling should be tolerated, but in my view, not encouraged in the way that it is today. The online gambling is particularly a focus on. There's such a huge array of addictive products that, as we've said, have been played in isolation with no limits. You can spend and lose as much money as you can possibly give. So that needs to be addressed. The industry are encouraging and incentivizing people to spend more and more money. It's not built on affordability. There are no checks and balances in place there, despite what the industry are saying. So those are a few things. There's many more, but the big message is to put public health first and think about creating a gambling industry that's sustainable for the long term, built on lower risk products on a more sustainable footing, rather than this rather egregious approach to the most high risk products and pushing people more and more towards that. So those are a few things I would mention.
Very interesting too. That's Matt Gaskill, who's clinical lead for the Northern NHS Gambling Clinics. Thanks for joining us. From May the 17th, as part of the lifting of lockdown restrictions, hurrah to that, I say, we're all going to be allowed to stay at another person's house. How exciting is that? Well, female writer Claudia Connor definitely isn't going to stay at anyone's house, and I don't think she's too keen on people coming to stay with her either. In a piece in today's Mail, she lists all the reasons why and joins me now. Claudia, what if your friends want to come and stay?
I sound like a right old misery dart.
You do.
Actually, I looked at the website and I've got hundreds and hundreds of people that secretly agree with me.
Yes.
I've got the main thing is I don't like staying at other people's house. I think sleepovers when you're 8 years old are very exciting. I think when you're 54, not so much.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I have a big, real bad thing about bathrooms. I want my own bathroom. So
yeah, own bathroom, own bed, own towels. Yeah,
exactly. And my partner is as bad as you, actually, Claude. You're as good as you. Call it what you will. And I say, why can't we stay open? No, we're staying in a hotel. Would you rather pay out to stay in a hotel than stay with a friend, or would you just get back to your own home somehow?
I would always, if they live too far away, I would always prefer to stay in a hotel. But sometimes if they're remote or they're clearly going to be very offended, then sometimes you have to sort of suck it up and stay with it, which makes you sound horrible because my friends can be lovely. I adore them. I just don't like staying in other people's houses.
Yeah, and you make the point as a single person, a night at a friend's house means you're in the kids' bedroom.
Yeah, because often they've sent their kids away.
Yeah.
So you're in some sort of, you're going from having a nice big double bed to yourself to sleeping in some sort of bunk bed with the Star Wars bed linen.
Yeah, or the futon, which you say is like sleeping on a giant anorak.
I'm surprised they still exist. I think they were quite sort of cool in the 80s. Everyone used to have a futon, but they're just so horribly uncomfortable.
Yeah, I have slept on one, actually. I shared one once with Amanda Pateau. It's a long story.
Okay.
Yeah, now, what of this, though? I think I completely resonated with this, where you said getting up time. What if you hear them having breakfast at 7 a.m, does that mean, oh my God, get out of bed quick to join them? Or is that because they don't want breakfast with you and they think you're going to sleep in for another hour and a half?
I think breakfast is the most awkward thing when you stay over with somebody, because you think, well, it's usually a weekend, and you think, well, if it's a Sunday, I wouldn't normally be getting up at 7 o'clock on a Sunday, but are they angry that I'm not joining them? And then it's also the whole thing of, oh God, do I get dressed? Do I get dressed and put my, or are they all going to be down there in their pyjamas? It's that thing as well.
And what about the loo or the bathroom without a lock?
Oh, I know. I'm surprised at how many people don't have a lock on their loo door. I suppose if it's yours and it's your family, it doesn't really matter if someone walks in on you. But if you're a guest, it's just, you just cannot relax if you think someone's going to barge in at any minute.
Yeah, and also I suppose you feel you've got to wear pyjamas or a nightie or something if you are staying in a friend's bed, rather than perhaps just going in the altogether.
Yes, I think you have to, out of respect, wear something, which means you then buy something, specially, which adds to the expense. And then it's quite uncomfortable to sleep in sort of pyjamas or some Victorian nightie if you're not used to it.
So the next time you get invited to stay to your friends, how do you get out of it? What do you say?
I'm probably never going to be invited again.
No, I think that's probably true, actually, yes.
Maybe I've solved the problem. Yeah.
Yeah, you have, really. But in the unlikely event someone hasn't read this piece and they say, you must stay, how do you diplomatically tiptoe out of that one by saying, actually, I'm going to stay in a hotel? Because that's going to offend them, isn't it?
Well, you can always say, oh, no, you've got so much on your plate, I don't want to put you into any trouble. What I can often say is, if they've got pets, I can say I've got an allergy, which actually I haven't, but it's quite a convenient excuse.
Right.
So I use that one quite a lot if they've got a cat or a dog.
What if they've only got a goldfish?
Yeah, a bit harder then. I'll always try and say, oh, I'm thinking of you. I've had a look, there's a premier in 5 minutes from you. I'll stay there.
Very interesting. Very good. Yeah. And on our website, Claudia, what is it in your favour? Is it about 70% to 30% or even higher?
I think it's even higher, Richard. I was quite surprised. I thought people would say, oh, you're old misery. But actually, an awful lot of people are saying, no, I agree. I'd never say it out loud, but I feel the same way.
That's the 54-year-old single misery, Claudia Connell.
Yes.
Thank you for joining us. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m, you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'm going to be back on Monday. Have yourselves a great weekend, particularly you, Sir Keir Starmer, and good night.